This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscawain. Back in June, if you wanted to buy a barrel of oil on the world market, you had to shell out about $115. Still a lot of money. Now you can get that same barrel of oil for less than $60. That's led to lower gasoline prices. The national average for regular is under $2.53 a gallon. And at the end of June, that price was $3.70. So if you buy 10 gallons of gas now, you're saving almost $12. That means people have more money to spend in stores this holiday season, but it also means less money flowing around drilling boom towns in North Dakota, Oklahoma, and Texas. Now, figuring out what all this means can be confusing, but fortunately, we have two great minds on the phone today to help us sort it out. Amy Myers Jaffe is Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Tom Kloza, Global Head of Energy Analysis at the Oil Price Information Service. Welcome to Radio Times, Tom.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing good. And we are going to spend this hour talking about oil prices. So let's start with you, Amy Myers Jaffe. Why are prices down now? What's going on in the world that the prices are down so much in such a short period of time?
Well, we've had some good luck situations and some bad luck situations. I think the first thing that threw the market off was that the Chinese economy started slowing down. And, of course, China's unbelievable growth over the last decade has been raising commodity prices worldwide, with a special emphasis on oil. So you have that sort of not prop of Chinese demand, and you know the global economy's recovery has been slower than expected. Well, in that context, we've had this amazing boom in oil production in the United States, and demand has not kept up, and so you had pressure on oil prices that was looked at geopolitically by big producers in the Arab Gulf, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And when they assessed their geopolitical interests and their long-term economic interests, now was a good time to have a lower price of oil. Targeted the Russians and maybe focused their attention on the fact that many players, including the United States, do not feel Russia has played a constructive role in Syria. It helped put some pressure on Iran in terms of its negotiations about its future nuclear program. And also, you know, if you're the rulers of Saudi Arabia and countries that have a lot of oil, seeing the success in California with electric cars and other kinds of advanced vehicles in the United States, which are expected to lower demand for oil by 2 or 3 million barrels a day in the coming years, this is not a good thing, so it might be a good time to lower the gasoline price.
And we had that the OPEC meeting on Thanksgiving Day, and we were already getting some signals from places like Saudi Arabia that they were not going to cut back production. Now, what would cutting back production on their end, what would that have done?
Well, you know, the market, the professional trading market had hoped that OPEC would cut production and that would stabilize the price. And it might have for a short period of time. But frankly, we have so much oil potential here in the United States that could be recovered through these advanced technologies of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling that, you know, it was a risky proposition for OPEC. They could have cut production, and that might have brought prices back up a little bit. But then maybe the market share would have gone to North American producers and not back to OPEC. And so they were in a very tricky situation, and they decided that maybe this lower price would help knock out competition.
Tom Kloza, let's turn to you, because whenever oil prices go up or down, that affects gasoline prices, because crude oil is the biggest component of the gasoline that we all use in our cars. What has this done to gasoline prices?
Oh, it's actually brought the price of gasoline down. The average price is above $2.50, but the most common price is about $2.39. The Energy Information Administration came out today and said that the average cost per family for 2015 is going to be about $1,962. It's been above $4,000 in some years. So people will have much more disposable income. I might remind everyone that the other problem with gasoline is there are a lot of hydrocarbons that sort of get blended into the gasoline mixture from the shale gas boom as well. And that's one of the reasons why you typically see prices weaker in the fall. But this is much, much beyond that. This is an absolute abysmal failure by the OPEC cartel. And it is a cartel, so it's difficult to root for them. But a failure to address what could be just an incredible surplus of oil in 2015.
I want to go back to those numbers you just mentioned from the Energy Information Administration. You're saying that they're estimating that for a family, what they're going to spend on gas is about $1,962 a year. And in some years, that's been as high as $4,000. You're talking about a lot of extra money rolling around in the economy right now.
Yeah, I differ with a lot of the business TV shows who keep talking about the dark underbelly or the dark side of these price drops. I think for the great, great majority of the population, this is really a good thing. If you talk about how much people are going to save on fuel, and if you talk about how much we're going to save in terms of transporting goods across the country, where diesel is the fuel for that, the prices have dropped immensely. You don't see it at the pump because most of the big fleets pay a cost-plus number, which is much lower than the sign you see. My only real regret here is that we've seen jet fuel prices drop to about 60% of what they were last year, and yet everyone seems to just acknowledge and not care that there's no pass along from the airline business. Perhaps the airlines are the closest thing to a cartel we have left out there.
Where are some of the lowest let's go switch back to gasoline prices for cars. Where are some of the lowest prices you're seeing in the country right now?
We're actually seeing the lows in places you wouldn't ordinarily expect them, in the Rocky Mountains, in the Southwest, Texas, anywhere that's close or very, very close to the Texas and Louisiana refiners. We've got about 15 states where you can buy gasoline for less than $2. The Northeast and the East Coast is a little bit higher than normal because one of the consequences of all of this is that we're not getting as many imports as we had been, and we're a little bit constrained with logistics. The Colonial Pipeline, which moves something like 3 million barrels of petroleum per day, is overbooked, and it's almost a StubHub kind of commerce that spawned from that, where people are paying 10 and 15 cents, almost like paying double and triple prices for Springsteen tickets to ship on the line. We will see probably half of the country flirt with a $2 or so number. But I want to underscore that these prices that we're seeing right now for averages probably really overstate how much most Americans are paying.
What do you mean?
Well, on average, the price may be $2.52, but a Costco station might move 1 million gallons of gasoline a month, and there might be someone else counted in the averages that moves 100,000 gallons a month. So one thing about a sharp price drop or a sharp price increase is it creates little behavioral changes where people will aggregate their visits and there are beneficiaries like the big box clubs during that.
And Amy, you told me a couple of weeks ago for a story that I was working on for NPR that a lot of analysts were predicting $70 per barrel oil. At that time, you predicted that you thought it was going to be more like $50. Did you really expect it would get down close to $50 this soon?
I did. And I think the real question is, somebody mentioned to me, well, why $50? And I thought, well, at this point, one has to ask, will there be other geopolitical features that are going to come into the market that'll actually psychologically hold it at 50? The last couple of days, the market's, bounced at in the 55 area. But will that be sustained? I think that, there are still these geopolitical factors out there. One has to assume that the government of Venezuela, which is so dependent on oil and has to pay back a giant loan of $60 billion to China, is going to have great difficulty. Vladimir Putin indicated this week that he was not at the pain point, but one has to wonder over time, you know, how close we are to a threshold that would make the economy of Russia very unstable. And so, you know, the question is, when's the first shoe going to drop? Or might there be an escalation in the war over Syria or some other place that would disrupt oil production? Because if that doesn't happen, I believe that the analysts are incorrect as to how low prices would have to go to really see a drop in production in the United States. There's a tendency to say, oh, you know, the shale costs $50 a barrel. But the way I describe it to people, that's sort of like I got 10 people screwing in a light bulb and, you know, could I do it with two? So the industry has shown over time, historically, a tremendous capacity for lowering costs. And in shale, actually recently, some companies like EOG and others have come up with formulas where they're using more sand as a proppant. That's, you know, when you do the spray the water gel into the rock and you need to hold the little tiny crevices open, you use a little particle of sand. Well, people are finding that mm-hmm. you use a little bit more sand, your recovery of oil could be 20 to 60% higher. So the question is, you know, say the drilling rig rate doesn't fall or say it just falls a little bit, you know, you still might be getting 25% more oil doing the same amount of drilling. And so it's unclear at what number OPEC would be successful at driving the price down to shut in U.S. production.
Yeah, because people just get more efficient if they have less money to work with.
And I said, well, listen, I think, you know, if you're Saudi Arabia, the thing that's pushing you out of the U.S. market is the Canadian oil sands. And, you know, that tends to be very expensive. But then people who I know work up in Canada have said, no, we can lower our costs as well. So, you know, the last time we had a major price war was in 1998 when we had what was called the Asian flu that slowed down all the economies in Asia. And the price of oil went down to $10 a barrel. Mm. And I'm not suggesting that will happen again per se, but one does have to wonder if even the $50 is going to hold, barring some major geopolitical event.
We are talking about the change in oil prices that has taken place over the last few months. They have dropped by just about half now from what they were in June. And my guest, you just heard there from Amy Myers Jaffe. She's Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis. We also have on the telephone Tom Kloza, Global Head of Energy Analysis at the Oil Price Information Service. They have a lot of knowledge about what's going on. If you have a question for him, join the conversation here. The telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. Email is radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, sitting in for Marty Moskowain today. We're talking about oil prices. They're down, way down from where they were just in June. If you want to join our conversation, we have two experts with us, Amy Myers Jaffe with University of California, Davis, and Tom Kloza at the Oil Price Information Service. They know a lot about what these markets are doing and even have some ideas about where we're headed. The telephone number to join the conversation is 1-888-477-9499. And Amy Jaffe, I'm going to turn to you. What do you see as sort of the significant effects? I mean, what are you going to be looking for here in coming months?
Well, I think the important thing to think about in terms of, you know, how will the market develop over time is, do people stop buying, you know, electric cars? Do people go back to buying SUVs? You know, I had a student tell me yesterday that he's going to drive home instead of taking the train. So the question is, if you're Southwest Airlines, you know, now all of a sudden maybe it'd be so much cheaper to drive than to take Southwest. That is going to put some pressure on the airlines to pass through some of the savings. So the question is, how will the competition be in terms of transportation mode? You know, does this mean that we'd be even cheaper to take Uber and the rest of us won't need to own a car? I mean, it's very interesting when you start to get a really cataclysmic shift like this in fuel prices. You know, how does it affect people's behavior? Do we find that millennials run out and get a driver's license now, or are they really committed to urban living, in which case we're not going to see demand bounce back?
And Tom Kloza, this idea that when prices go down, people consume more of something, I guess it doesn't always hold with gasoline, right?
Well, I hope it doesn't hold. I mean, that would be a real dark cloud in the silver lining of the lower prices here. I mean, one of the other things that's brought this about, particularly in North America, and North America has had some of the biggest declines, is that we've got a lower demand curve, particularly for gasoline. Now, some of that is due to the younger people not rushing out to drive and using social media more and not actually meeting up in person as much. But I would say the single best piece of climate legislation passed in our lifetimes was probably the CAFE standards. And the CAFE standards are great. They're going to basically make sure that we're using less and perhaps we'll be producing more. And I would hate to think that people are going to go out and watch football and get some of these big, huge vehicles. Or that there might be some effort to slide back on the CAFE standards, because that is definitely part of this bouillabaisse that's brought about lower prices and much more moderate numbers for the population.
The CAFE standards you mentioned there, remind us what that is?
Sure. I mean, these laws were passed years ago, and essentially, and you can have some arguments about whether a standard really means 36.5 miles per gallon by 2016 and about 54 miles per gallon. But the auto manufacturers have to come out with more efficient cars, and they've been doing wonderfully in that regard. You know, the average car now coming out each month is getting about 26 miles per gallon. If you look at current prices, that means for $20, you can go well over 200 miles and have much less of a carbon footprint.
I think we'll just point out that CAFE also, it stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy. So for each automaker, they have to be able to get sort of, they have to hit a target, right?
Right. And they're doing a great job. I mean, one of the problems with this, and Amy mentions electric or fuel cell technologies, is that a lot of the engineering for that and a lot of planning for that was based on $100 plus crude and perhaps $4 or $5 prices for fuel. This is going to make it more difficult to adopt some of the alternative fuels within North America, for sure. I mean, gasoline prices are kind of the third rail of American politics, and you could probably make the case that one of the great things out there, or one of the absolute no-brainers out there, would be to raise the fuel tax on gasoline for infrastructure, along with some other potential gains, but it's very difficult to do politically.
You know, this. I want to go back to this idea that economists sort of in basic stuff will say that prices go down, people might consume more of something, but that doesn't hold with gasoline. I saw an interesting analysis that suggested kind of a counterintuitive thing might happen here, that people might go and use the money that they're saving on gasoline and go out and buy a new car, which is probably going to get better mileage. Or if you're an airline and they're saving all this money and sticking it in the bank account that they're not spending on fuel, they might go out and buy new planes and there'd be more efficient planes. So this could be a case where gasoline prices go down and fuel consumption declines because people go out and buy new machines. Does that sound like something that could happen to you, Amy?
Yeah, you know, Jeff, you really hit the nail on the head, and that might be one of the big mistakes that when we look back in history, we'll say, you know, OPEC signed its own death certificate. So it's not just that if I buy a new car today, it's definitely going to get better get better gasoline mileage, or if I, you know, there's new aircraft, they might be performing better. It's also we're having a boom in what we call big data analytics, so using software to get my so-called machinery or my hardware to perform better. And there are unbelievable tools today where, you know, an airline can go to an Oracle or a GE and have them work with their own operational big data and show them how to change their flight patterns using a computer software program to reduce fuel. And people are having experiences where across the industry, companies are finding that they're having 10% gain in how, in other words, they're using 10% less fuel to do the same activity. The U.S. military apparently applied that kind of big data analytics and reduced their jet fuel demand by 20%. So the question is, you know, in the typical boom and bust oil and oil cycle, you know, we get to lower prices, they stick for a little while, people forget, you know, what it was like to have to pay a high price, and so they start, you know, being less efficient or driving more or so forth. But, you know, I'm wondering if we're really going to have the same return to demand as we've seen in the past, because you have this big data analytics that's going to help bring a lot more energy efficiency and software in buildings. We've got technologies like Nest, which is regulating your home for you. And the answer is, no matter how low energy prices are, why would you spend your money on energy when, you know, like you say, we could be going on holiday or going to the movies more, or, you know, buying a new pair of jeans? So sure. It could wind up being both very economically beneficial as people spend their money on something else. And also, there's really no reason to go back to spending that money on fuel, because there are all these fuel efficient technologies that are going to be available.
Yeah, I guess we don't spend money on gasoline because we love gasoline. We spend it on it because we have to get from one place to another. Let's go. We have a comment from Beatrice in New Jersey, and she says, I'm loving the fact that gas prices have dropped, but I'm not feeling the effects of lower oil prices at the supermarket. She asks, shouldn't food costs drop because they're cheaper to transport? Is that a question either of you can answer?
I'll take a shot on it, and I say, be patient, Beatrice. I do think you'll see the cost of many things that get transported across the country drop. I know beef prices are dropping right now, and maybe that'll happen with chicken. If you bought a chicken this year, you know how much it costs these days. But those lower prices for diesel should yield some benefits in the form of getting rid of some of the surcharges, because they could always just tack on the freight. And I would remind you that the prices for diesel are much, much lower for the big fleets and for the railroads than what you actually see at the pump right now. So I think patience will be rewarded. I think this will infiltrate every nook and cranny of petroleum prices and where they're used, with the exception of the airlines, where it seems as though they can get away with whatever they want right now.
That's Tom Close. He's with the Oil Price Information Service. We also have Amy Myers Jaffe from UC Davis. If you want to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's go to the telephone. We have Chris from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Chris, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. I just have a question about the long-term economic impacts of this. Are consumers trusting that these low prices are going to last? As a millennial, I'm not rushing out to purchase a car because I really don't trust OPEC and this price dip. If prices were to spike in, say, 2016, won't the economy take a huge hit because we all adjusted to these low prices and now all of a sudden?
Sure. Amy, go ahead and answer that question, because you're already mentioning the boom and bust there. And
you know, that's a high risk. I mean, if the low prices cause a major government to founder, if ISIS, you know, were to really make gains in Iraq and get to the more important oil fields, I mean, there are all kinds of things that could happen that could change the psychology of the market. You know, if there was some kind of there was an incident where an ISIS cell blew up a small pipeline in Saudi Arabia, so no big deal. But if they, you know, got to some major facility, we'd see the price come right back up. So I do think that that could happen. But what I would say is, you know, in oil, there are certain trend lines, and we've been really in a boom cycle for a long time, you know, over 10 years. And what I would say is that we've put in place all the components to have a long-term downturn. As Tom mentioned, you know, structurally, every car that gets purchased today is going to get better and better gasoline mileage over time. You know, the chances of China's economy going back to 12 or 15% growth a year seems very unlikely at this juncture. And so I do think that it'll take a while for the global economy to recover. It will be coming into better technologies, building processes, and so forth. So, you know, I'd like to hope, and also I'd like to hope that you millennials are much more concerned about climate change and much more willing not to behave the way we baby boomers did when we were your age. So I'm hoping that that we could stay in a lower price environment, you know, barring some real catastrophic geopolitical event. I'm hoping that we're in a trend line that could last for a number of years. But indeed, the caller makes a valid point, which is that especially businesses don't respond quickly to low prices because, again, there's some insecurity about how long it's going to last.
Hmm. And I don't suppose, Tom, you're really encouraging Chris to go out and buy a car just because gas prices are down right now?
No, it's interesting, though, because, I mean, the number of people from the ages of 15 to 30 that have driver's licenses now or that drive is lower than it's been in several generations. And baby boomers represent one of the fastest growing demographics. And traditionally, maybe not with this class, but people drive much less over 55. I do want to remark something relative to what the caller said, and that is that we may have crude oil everywhere, but the United States is still very susceptible to occasional and very brief price spikes. You will see a price spike, a very notable price spike, if you have a Gulf Coast hurricane. We haven't solved the problems that were seen when there was the mass exodus of people after hurricanes Katrina and Rita. And you will see it even rear its head in some other parts of the country because, you know, Michael Dell taught the world how to do just-in-time inventory back in the 80s, and it's very much a just-in-time inventory system for gasoline and diesel in this country. And that means when you have some of the infrastructure go down, you can have a very brief spike. But I would maintain that it's a much more temperate future, and those would be exceptions rather than the standard.
Let's go back to the telephone, and we have Suma from Center City. Suma, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, it's a very interesting topic. I'm from West Africa, Sierra Leone, yet a virgin land in terms of building the infrastructures of energy. So considering the current trend, I'm in the process of writing an energy policy for our political party, a new political party that is poised to take up the leadership come 2017. We're now debating as to which. I was wondering if your guest on the show has some viewpoint that she can share with me that one we may want to look into whilst you're preparing an energy policy to build infrastructure for the next 20, 25 or more years.
So, Amy, do you have some advice for Suma for a paper on developing countries that are putting together energy infrastructure?
Well, you know, one of the new trends for the developing world is to look more at what we call distributed energy. So instead of building a giant power station in the capital city and trying to have everybody revolve around one power station. In a country like Sierra Leone, that means that people who live in rural areas have no access to the benefits of fuel and electricity. So one of the things that people are looking increasingly at is small-scale electricity. So systems that might serve a smaller community, a village or a small city, using their own resources. So that could be bioenergy, waste-to-energy plants, or solar, utility-scale solar. You're seeing, you know, even here in the United States, some people are looking more at fuel cells. So that sort of off-grid, community-scale electricity is becoming a more interesting paradigm for doing energy development. And even here in California, where people have had mixed experiences, where, you know, we had the California electricity crisis, and if you're a Microsoft, you can't afford to have your electricity go off even for 2 minutes because of your servers or your keeping your chips cool. There are a lot of new interesting technologies coming out and software systems where, you know, towns like Palo Alto were saying, well, we want to be off-grid and we want to have our own solution. And after Hurricane Sandy, out through Staten Island, New Jersey, you're also seeing some interest in that. So understanding those small-scale grids and how they might serve best the needs of Africa, I think, is something that is worth looking at, because in India and some other places, that's turning out to be a successful paradigm for developing energy supply.
Well, we are going to be up against a break here in just a minute, but I want to remind our listeners that we are talking about oil prices. If you open up the business section, you've probably noticed that the prices are down almost half of what they were just about 6 months ago. If you have a question for our guests, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. And our guests are, you just heard there from Amy Myers Jaffe. She's Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis. And we also have on the telephone Tom Cloza with the Oil Price Information Service. That telephone number again, 1-888-477-9499. The email address is radiotimes@whyy.org. And if you want to tweet us, that handle is @WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break. This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about oil prices this hour with Amy Myers Jaffe of UC Davis, University of California, Davis, and Tom Cloza with the Oil Price Information Service. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. We received an email from William, and I think this is a good question for Tom. William says, he asks about heating oil and points out that it's sold to, you know, a lot of people in the Northeast here in the U.S., and many of those customers are senior citizens and older, less fuel-efficient homes. And he says crude prices may drop a lot, gasoline prices may go down, but heating oil prices don't seem to drop by as much. Do you know why that, first of all, do you know if that's accurate, and if so, why that is?
Well, his heating oil dealer right now.
We cut off the beginning of you there. You were suggesting that William call his heating oil dealer?
Absolutely. I think if William calls his heating oil dealer, if he shops around, he will find that he's going to be able to get heating oil today for about $2.50 a gallon, compared to somewhere in the 4 to 4.25 neighborhood last year. A typical household that uses heating oil in the Northeast, they are going to have a serendipitous winter. They're going to be looking at 800 gallons if it's a typical winter, and maybe saving $1 or $1.25 on that 800 gallons versus last year. So if you were to identify the region which is the most immediate and prominent beneficiary of this oil price collapse, it would be New England and Middle Atlantic homeowners who use heating oil. The prices have dropped. He may just need to coerce his dealer into acknowledging that.
And maybe if he knows one of these senior citizens he's talking about, help them sort of negotiate something better.
Yeah, you know, you don't have the prominence, you don't have the top of mind visibility for those prices out there, but certainly those numbers are out there. And it's not as though demand drops. There are places in California where people are charging $4 to $5 for gasoline at the pump right now, but people recognize when they drive around they've got alternatives where they can do considerably better. The same is true for heating oil. The same is true for diesel fuel.
And Amy, I want to turn to you and talk a little bit about oil sands production in Alberta, because the Keystone XL pipeline in the news a lot, and we're waiting for a decision from the Nebraska Supreme Court before the administration makes a final decision on whether to approve that project. That kind of oil is pretty expensive to produce. How are the companies that produce that oil sands or tar sands oil from up in Alberta, how are they faring in this lower price environment?
Well, I think, you know, when you look on the scale of projects that are too expensive in the new, you know, price regime, should it hold, you know, oil sands is definitely in that category. I would also say, you know, the other most vulnerable things is maybe it doesn't make sense to drill. Certainly it doesn't make sense to drill in the Russian Arctic, but maybe even in our Arctic, you know, state of Alaska is going to have to reevaluate itself. They were already facing the possibility of budget deficits. They have a very interesting program in the state of Alaska where every year they write every citizen a check for $2,000 or $3,000 of their share of the oil wealth. But that is going to really damage the state budget over time if oil prices stay low. And again, it makes the projects of drilling up there, you know, much less attractive. So, but for oil sands, you know, I can remember a time in the 90s when, of course, that was maybe some more easier surface material, but that could be produced at $10 or $12 a barrel. So I think you'll see some costs come down in Canada, maybe some of the high salaries for workers or for equipment is going to come down, price of the electricity and other energy that's needed to do the steam is going to come down. So, but they are still vulnerable because it's the most expensive oil out there. So that raises this question, you know, as oil prices come down, you know, what's our priority? Are we going to stay the course with our concerns about climate change and how is that going to affect our policies towards the strategies we're going to choose on climate? Tom mentioned, you know, the obvious opportunity one would have today is, you know, it's going to be a little less of a drag on the economy to have a carbon tax, for example, because the energy prices would be generally low. And so the possibility of having a carbon tax would be less penalizing. But, you know, in the political domain, hard to know how all that would play out.
And Tom, let's talk about some other businesses, refineries. We don't really think about these people sort of in the middle of the process between the crude oil and our gas tank. But how does lower prices affect refineries?
Well, in theory, the refineries have been the beneficiary, not so much of lower prices, but of the North American discounts. I mean, one of the things that changes with this lowering of prices globally is that North America for the past 4 years, really since the first Arab Spring, has been the privileged continent. Much of that privilege is in the very, very cheap prices of natural gas. But we've seen at various times where the different crude oil blends in North America have traded, depending on quality, for anywhere from a couple of dollars to as much as $60 under worldwide prices. So we'll lose some of that continental advantage for refineries. But generally, the refineries have done well. And, you know, they're in a little bit of a rough period right now. But I would venture to say that the most sophisticated complex refineries in the world are located at the U.S. Gulf Coast. And we have become merchants to the world. We are the suppliers to South America and the Caribbean, and I don't suspect that'll change.
And let's talk about the retailers, the local service stations. They actually benefit when prices go down, right? They can earn more money when prices are going down than they do when prices are going up?
They are doing wonderfully right now. They are having, if to use a baseball analogy, they are having the biggest inning they've ever had in their lifetimes. As people think they feel sorry for the poor retailer on the way down, but their margins go up because it's not compelling to drop prices as much as the wholesale market has, because demand is remaining relatively steady. So briefly, instead of making 15 or 16 cents in gross margin on gasoline, they might make 30 or 40 cents. One of the big losers in all of this, by the way, are the credit card companies, who can charge 2, 3, 4% on every credit card purchase of gasoline, about 65% of the total. And they like $4 gasoline. They don't like $2 gasoline because it cuts their revenues tremendously.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. We received an email from Richard who said, kind of came in the middle of the discussion, was wondering why exactly prices are down again. So I'll try to summarize that, and you guys can tell me if I'm correct before we go on to the other calls. But essentially, we have a situation where there's more oil sloshing around the world, and a lot of it is coming from places like North Dakota and Oklahoma. And at the same time, in the United States, you've got demand sort of softening. In fact, gasoline consumption is, I think it peaked in 2006 or 2007 and has been on the decline ever since. So you've got one of those classic situations where you've got plenty of supply and weaker than expected demand, and that's sending prices down. Is that a decent summary?
Yeah, the one thing I would add, and Amy mentioned, is that, you know, there was kind of this silly sense among some of the folks in business that the developing world was going to go through their own industrial revolution and not use significantly enhanced or very wise choices for energy. And clearly, they're leapfrogging to some of the better choices on that. So that was a big misread of the way that things would happen in China and other places, that they might be driving around in cars from the Dukes of Hazzard or something similar to that. And they're moving to the better technologies.
Huh. Let's go to the telephone. We have Paul from Reading on the line. Paul from Reading, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering, with the consumer economy being, or the consumer being two-thirds of our economy, why the stock market has reacted so negatively to the drop in oil prices.
What's going on there? Can either of you answer that, Amy or Tom?
You know, I honestly, because, you know, one always wants to say the market's wrong. I think that what the caller is saying is actually very valid. You're going to have a lot of sort of, it's like a stimulus package, and it's a stimulus package for the Obama administration targeting exactly who, you know, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen said we needed to. It's targeting lower-income Americans and middle-class Americans. So to that extent, you'd think it'd be very helpful. So what I think that Wall Street is concerned about is something like, you know, Venezuela defaulting on its debt, or having, you know, oil producing countries default on their bank loans. And, you know, when you combine that with what Tom just talked about, how, you know, the credit card companies are going to be making a little less money on purchases of gasoline and so forth, I guess there's just a sense that maybe in the financial sector, you know, this could be problematical, or that for companies in the Fortune 500 that are oil companies are going to do worse. And, you know, I sort of question that logic a little bit. You know, the sort of business paradigm for the big companies like ExxonMobil or Shell has been faltering a bit because they were doing these far-flung projects in Australian LNG or in Arctic drilling that really were not making money. They were not. They were expecting certain returns. They were having cost overruns. Those returns were not coming to them. And so I think the street was too positive on those companies. They have, you know, we have this whole concept of the carbon bubble. Does it make sense to have giant resources that we're going to be able to produce over the next 50 years? Or might we go to some other kind of alternative energy? And so I do think that, you know, there's always this problem of how wild swings in something like commodity prices affects sovereign debt, and that's definitely a concern. But, you know, there are these other features having to do with the consumer sector that I think also is a positive. So I guess time will tell.
Tom, we're really sort of like adding up the pluses and minuses of these lower oil prices. And since I cover energy for NPR, I hear a lot from people in the oil business, you know, about the downsides of lower oil prices. Do we know yet, ultimately, if it's going to be a net plus or minus to the country as a whole?
No, I don't think we do. And there's certainly worries about black swan events out there that could be happening, like a sovereign debt collapse. But I would add to what Amy said and say there's a very, very significant difference between a strong stock market in a country and a strong economy. I mean, China has had incredibly strong stock markets, but that does not mean that much of the population is not desperately poor. So I believe on balance, particularly if we do find a point of stasis or stability, maybe in the neighborhood of where we are right now, that the benefits are going to be huge. And the benefits are going to be with the people who live paycheck to paycheck. If you're Harold Hamm and you just paid $1 billion for your divorce settlement and you called the bottom at $80, you are a loser and not a winner in this.
And we should say that Harold Hamm is an oil company executive who's big in the shale play in the middle of the country.
Right. And he did have, I think, the most expensive divorce settlement that's being challenged right now.
It was a pretty penny. I want to try to squeeze one more telephone call in here from Rick. Rick is calling us from Delaware. Rick, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm at your show. I just wanted to comment. It looks like the Saudis are seeing a golden opportunity to put a pretty good hurting on some of their arch rivals in Iran, for numerous reasons. Also, us with the North Dakota to halt a lot of the to slow down drilling, and also Russia, and they're succeeding quite nicely. And I wondered about your comments that, you know, the Saudis are not backing off on their production because they have a long game.
Okay, so let's go to Amy. Is this all up to the Saudis?
Well, you know, the Saudis do have a long game. And, you know, when they didn't like the fact that the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan, they played this same card. And it turned out well. The Soviet Union collapsed and Afghanistan remained in the hands of you know, Muslim government. So, and the Russians became like Russia's Vietnam. So, you know, that's been noticed in Moscow. The official Russian newspaper said that, you know, the United States is conspiring with Saudi Arabia for regime change in Moscow. And I'm not sure that that's really what's on the agenda, but for sure, the Saudis have a lot of different goals that they can meet by lowering the price right now, and they have $700 or $800 billion in foreign reserves to sort of pad them over to whatever, you know, sort of budget problems they might have internally. So, yeah, I think they're playing the long game.
All right.
Not in Saudi Arabia's interest to see Russia being militarily adventurous. They don't like to see Iran being militarily adventurous. And they have no interest in having the entire United States switch to dual fuel cars. You know, I have a car that runs both on electricity and gasoline. And I can tell you, recently I was making a long trip with the car and I had to use the gasoline and I couldn't even remember how to open the gasoline tank. It had been so long since I hadn't driven around on electricity. So if you're Saudi Arabia, you know, you have a lot of oil. You want that. So that's the one thing you have. And you need people to continue to use it. Lower prices is going to help you with that goal, too.
Well, that's Amy Myers Jaffe. She is Executive Director of Energy and Sustainability at the University of California, Davis. And we're going to wrap up here. But I did want to point out that we did see one of the signs of that Russia is in trouble. They increased the amount of interest that their central bank is paying. It was 10.5% up to 17%. Still doesn't seem to be having an effect. The ruble is still really low compared to the dollar. But a lot of effects of lower oil prices. Again, Amy Myers Jaffe from University of California, Davis, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Tom Kloza, he's the Global Head of Energy Analysis at the Oil Price Information Service. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find our Twitter handle, Facebook feed, and a lot of other information. The engineer for today's show, Kevin Griffin. The producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscawain.